Mein Kampf, Volume 1, Chapter 5, The First World War. What depressed me more than anything when I was a wild youth was that I had been born into an age that honored only tradesmen or civil servants. The surge of large waves seen in history seemed to have calmed down so much that the future belonged only to the peaceful competition of people, or to quiet mutual swindling where any aggressive method of self-defense had been abandoned. More and more, the individual nations began to resemble businesses that mutually undercut one another, stole customers and orders, and tried to outwit each other in every way, while making protests as loud as they were harmless. This development not only seemed to progress, but it was generally hoped it would someday transform the world into one huge department store where the reception area would, for all time, display statues of the most skillful manipulators and most harmless executives. The English could then furnish the businessmen, the Germans would furnish the administrative officials, and the Jews would have to sacrifice themselves as managers since they speak the most languages and, by their own admission, they never make a profit, but keep paying forever. Why couldn't I have been born 100 years sooner? Say at the time of the Wars of Liberation, the Napoleonic War of the Six Coalition, 1812 to 1814, against France, when a man had some value apart from the business which he operated. It often annoyed me when I thought that my life started too late. I believe the age of peace and good order in front of me was an undeserved, cruel strike of fate. Even as a boy, I was no pacifist, and every attempt to push me in that direction was a failure. Then, the Boer War, fought between Britain and two African Boer republics, 1889 to 1902, appeared like a bright light on my horizon. Every day, I anxiously waited the newspapers. I devoured news reports and letters. I was happy to witness this heroic struggle, even if it was from a distance. During the Russo-Japanese War, commonly called the Manchurian Campaign, in 1904 to 1905, between Russia and Japan over Manchuria and Korean territories, I was more mature and more observant. Here, I took sides for more rational reasons and supported the Japanese in every discussion we had. I saw the defeat of the Russian as a defeat of the Austrian Slavs. Years had passed since then, and what I thought was slow-moving weakness as a boy, I now believed to be the calm before the storm. Even in my Vienna days, the Balkans, the peninsula territories of East Italy, were burning under the feeble heat that usually predicts the approach of a hurricane. Flashes of light were already beginning to flicker, only to be lost again in the strange darkness. Then came the Balkan War of 1912 to 1913, and with it, the first puff of wind whipped across a nervous Europe. The approaching events weighed on men like a nightmare, like feverish, brooding tropical heat, and it continued until the constant worry finally returned the feeling of approaching catastrophe into desire. Let heaven give in to the destiny that could not be avoided. Then the first mighty flash of lightning struck the earth. The storm broke, and the thunder of the sky was mixed with the roar of the artillery in the First World War. When news of the murder of Archduke Francis Ferdinand arrived in Munich, I was sitting at home and caught only bits and pieces of what happened. The assassination of Archduke Francis Ferdinand sparked the First World War when Austria-Hungary declared war against Serbia. At first, I was afraid and worried that the bullets had come from the pistol of a German student. They were angry at the Crown Prince over his constant work to convert the nation to a Slav region, and they wanted to free the German people from this enemy within. It was easy to imagine what the result would have been, a new wave of persecution against German elements in Austria, which would have been thoroughly justified by the whole world. But immediately afterward, I found myself dumbfounded at the way fate played her game of mysterious revenge when I heard the names of the suspected assassins. They were Serbians. The greatest friend to Slavs was brought down by fanatical Slav patriot's bullet. Anyone who had watched the relationship between Austria and Serbia in previous years could have no doubt that this act started boulders rolling that could never be stopped. It isn't fair to criticize the Vienna government today for the method and theme of the ultimatum it presented then. No other power in the world could have acted differently in a similar situation. On her southeast border, Austria had an unyielding, deadly enemy that kept provoking the monarchy more and more often and would have never stopped until their time came to shadow the empire. There was good reason to fear this would happen with the death of the old Kaiser. By then, perhaps the monarchy would not be in any position to offer serious resistance. In its last years, the whole state rested completely on Francis Joseph, and the broad masses felt that the death of this aged incarnation of the empire meant the death of the empire itself. More than that, it was one of the sly tricks of the Slavic policy that they were able to create the impression that the Austrian state owed its continued existence exclusively to the monarch's marvelous and unique skill. This piece of flattery pleased the Austrian Hofburg imperial palace even more because the emperor didn't deserve it. The sting hidden in this eulogy was not noticed. People either did not see or did not want to see that the more the monarchy depended on the outstanding governing skill, as they called this, of this wisest monarch of all times, the more catastrophic the situation was destined to be when fate finally knocked at the door to demand its due. Could old Austria think without the old Kaiser? Would not the tragedy of Maria Theresa be repeated? Maria Theresa was an Archduchess of Austria and the only ruler until 1765, when she recognized her own son, Joseph II, as co-regent. She unified the Habsburg monarchy, but after the death of her husband withdrew and was no longer active as a monarch, even though she had made many civil reforms earlier. In parentheses. No, it is really unfair to Vienna government circles to blame them for starting a war that otherwise might have been avoided. It could no longer have been avoided. Probably postponed for 1 or 2 years, but not avoided. The curse of German and Austrian diplomacy was that it had always tried to postpone the inevitable reckoning until it was finally forced to strike at the most inopportune moment. We can be sure that another attempt at peace would only have brought on the war at an even more unfavorable time. Anyone who did not want this war must have the courage to accept the consequences of their past refusal. This consequence could not or could have only been the sacrifice of Austria. The war would still have to come, but probably not with everyone united against us. Instead, it would have meant the separation of the Habsburg monarchy. It was necessary to decide whether to take part or simply gawk empty-handed while destiny took its course. The very people who today curse the loudest and pass judgment about starting the war were the ones who took the most fatal part in leading us to it. For decades, the Social Democrats had been sneaky in their efforts to spark war against Russia. The German Centrist Party, a Catholic political party, on the other hand, had made the Austrian state the pivotal point of German policy for religious reasons. Now, the results of the craziness were upon us. What came next was inevitable and could no longer be avoided under any circumstances. The German government's share of the guilt was that, in its effort to preserve peace, it missed all the best moments to fight. It became wrapped up in the alliance to preserve the world peace and finally became the victim of a world coalition, which was absolutely determined to oppose a world war and to preserve world peace at any cost. Even if the Vienna government had given an ultimatum in more palatable terms, it would not have changed the situation, but instead it might have generated public outrage if the masses saw the ultimatum as too moderate and certainly not extreme or excessive. Anyone who denies this today is either a forgetful blockhead or an intentional liar. The First World War of 1914 was not forced on the masses, but it was demanded by the people. They wanted to finally put an end to the lingering uncertainty. Only on that ground can we understand how more than 2 million German men followed the flag into this supreme struggle, ready to protect it with their last drop of blood. To me, those days seem like deliverance from the anger of my youth. Even now, I am not ashamed to say that I fell on my knees, overcome by a wave of enthusiasm, and thanked heaven from an overflowing heart that it had granted me the good fortune to live in this time. A battle for freedom had begun, whose unparalleled greatness the earth had never seen. Destiny had barely begun to take its course before the great masses started to realize that this time it was not just Serbia's or Austria's fate at stake, but the existence of the German people itself. After many years, the people could finally see the future. At the very outset of the monstrous struggle, the intoxicating and extravagant enthusiasm was quickly replaced by the necessary serious undertones. Only this realization made the nation's exaltation more than just a passing fad. This was necessary because the majority of the people did not have the slightest idea how long the battle would be. They dreamed of soldiers being home again by winter so they could return to their peaceful jobs. What man wants, he also hopes for and believes in. The overwhelming majority of the nation was sick of the eternal uncertainty. So it was understandable that no one believed in a peaceful solution of the Austrian-Serbian conflict, and instead hoped for a final settlement. I was one of those millions. The first news of the assassination had barely reached Munich when two ideas flashed through my mind. First, war was now unavoidable, but beyond this, the Habsburg state would now be compelled to stick to its alliance. What I had always feared most was the possibility that someday Germany itself might be involved in a conflict that was not caused by Austria. Then, for domestic political reasons, the Austrian state would not have the resolution to back up its ally. Even though the alliance had already been made, the Slavic majority of the empire would have sabotaged it at once, and would have preferred to shatter the whole state rather than give help to their ally. The danger was now removed. The old Austrian state had to fight whether it wanted to or not. My own attitude towards the conflict was perfectly clear and simple. What I saw was not Austria fighting for some satisfaction against Serbia, but Germany fighting for her all. The real battle was the German nation fighting for its existence or non-existence, for its freedom and future. Bismarck's creation must now go out and fight. What its fathers had once conquered in battle with their heroic blood, from Weissenberg to Sedan and Paris, young Germany had to now earn back. If the battle was victorious, then our people would rejoin the circle of great nations once more. The German Empire could prove itself again as a mighty stronghold of peace without having to put its children on short rations for the sake of maintaining peace. As a boy and a young man, I had often wished I could demonstrate that my nationalistic enthusiasm was no empty obsession. It often seemed to me almost a sin to cry out in joy with the crowd without having any real right to do so. Who could rightfully shout hooray without having tried it, when all the pettiness is over and the goddess of fate's cruel hand begins to test the strength of everyone's convictions? Like millions of others, my heart overflowed with happiness now that I could be free of this paralyzing feeling. I had sung Deutschland über alles, Germany ahead of all, the actual song title is The Song of Germany, and shouted Heil so often at the top of my lungs. Now, it seemed to me almost like heavenly grace granted retroactive justice by allowing me to testify to the truth of my convictions and prove they were real. I knew from the first moment that in the face of an inevitable war, I would abandon my books immediately. I also knew that my place must be where the inner voice of conscience sent me. I left Austria primarily for political reasons. Now that the struggle was beginning, it seemed natural that I should review my convictions. I would not fight for the Austrian Habsburg state, but I was ready to die for my people and for the German Empire they belonged to. On the 3rd of August, 1914, I presented a petition to His Majesty King Ludwig III requesting permission to join a Bavarian regiment. During those days, the Cabinet Chancellery had a lot to deal with, but I was overjoyed when I received an answer to my request the very next day. I opened the letter with trembling hands and read that my petition was granted and I was instructed to enroll in a Bavarian regiment. My gratitude and joy was unbelievable. In a few days, I was wearing the uniform that I would wear for the next 6 years. For me, and probably for every German, the greatest and most unforgettable period in my life, earthly life, now began. Compared to the events of this incredible struggle, everything in my past paled as if it was nothing. Now, as the 10th anniversary of the great event approaches, I think back with melancholy pride about those weeks at the beginning of the heroic struggle for our people, where fate graciously allowed me to take part. It seems like just yesterday. Image after image goes through my mind. I see myself uniformed and with my beloved comrades. We are marching out for the first time, drilling until the day our departure finally came, and I and many others were worried whether or not we would arrive too late at the front. This often kept me awake at night. In the victorious delight we took when we heard about each new heroic deed, there was also some irritation, since each new victory seemed to increase the danger that we would arrive too late to play our part. At last, the day came when we left Munich to fall in and do our duty. I saw the Rhine River for the first time as we were traveling beside its gentle waves on our way west to protect it. The Rhine, the German river of rivers, we were now going to protect it from the greed of our old enemy. When the gentle rays of the dawn first beamed down on us through the delicate veil of morning mist of the Niederwald Monument, a statue that commemorates the founding of the German Empire after the Franco-Prussian War, the old song, Wacht am Rhein, Guard on the Rhine, roared from the long transport train in the morning sky, and my heart was ready to burst in patriotic pride. Then came a cold, wet night in Flanders, and we marched through it in silence. When day began to break through the mist, we were suddenly met with an iron greeting as it hissed over our heads. With a sharp crack, it hurled the little pellets of shrapnel through our ranks, splashing up the wet soil. Before the little cloud was gone, the first hooray came from 200 voices in response to this greeting by the Angel of Death. Then the crackling and thunder began, singing and howling, and with feverish eyes, everyone marched forward, faster and faster. At last, across beet fields and hedges, the battle began, the battle of man against man. From a distance, the sound of song reached our ears, coming closer and closer, and jumping from company to company. Just as death began to busy himself in our ranks, the song reached us too, and we in turn passed it on. Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles in der Welt. I don't even know if I got the syntax right, but that's the words. Germany before all, Germany head of everything in the world. 4 days later, we went back to camp. We even walked differently. 17-year-old boys now looked like men. Maybe the volunteers of the List Regiment, the 2nd Infantry Bavarian Regiment, had not really learned to fight, but they did know how to die, like old soldiers. That was the beginning. That's how it went on year after year, but horror had replaced the romance of battle. Enthusiasm gradually cooled down, and the wild excitement was smothered in deadly fear. For each man, the time came when he had to struggle between the instinct of self-preservation and the obligations of duty. I was not exempt from this struggle. Whenever death was close, a vague something in me tried to revolt and tried to disguise itself as reason to the weak body, but it was still just the sly cowardice laying sneaky traps. A great tugging and warning would begin, and only the last remnant of conscience would get me through the day. But the harder this voice worked to caution me, and the louder and more piercingly it spoke to me, the stiffer my resistance became, until finally, after a long inner struggle, duty won. This struggle was decided for me by the winter of 1915 to 1916. My will had finally become the absolute master. The first few days I ran to the fight laughing and gloating, but now I was calm and determined. That was the frame of mind that would endure. Now I could proceed to the final trial of fate without nerves cracking or the mind failing. The young volunteer had become an old soldier. This transformation had taken place throughout the army. They had come out of the perpetual battle older and stronger, and whatever could not stand up to the storm was simply broken. Only now it was fair to judge this army. After 2 or 3 years of fighting one battle after another, always fighting a force greater in numbers and weaponry, starving and suffering hardships, then was the time to judge the value of that unique army. Thousands of years from now, no one will speak of heroism without mentioning the German army in the First World War. Through the veil of history, the iron front of gray steel helmets will appear, unswerving and unyielding, a monument of immortality. As long as there are Germans, they will remember that these were sons of their forefathers. When I was a soldier, I did not want to talk politics. That was not the time for it. To this day, I am convinced that the last stable boy was more valuable to the fatherland than the first parliamentarian. I had never hated these windbags more than now, as every quiet, truthful lad said what he had to say point blank in the face of an enemy, or else left the small talk at home and focused on doing his duty in silence. Yes, at that time I hated all these politicians, and if I had my say about it, a parliamentary pick and shovel brigade would have been formed at once. There they could have chattered between themselves to their heart's content without annoying or harming decent, honest humanity. I wanted nothing to do with these politics, but could not help adopting attitudes towards things that affected the whole nation, and especially to things that affected us as soldiers. There were two things which annoyed me at the time that I thought were harmful to our interests. After the very first report of victory, a certain section of the press began slowly, and possibly unnoticed to some, to sprinkle a few drops of bitterness into the general enthusiasm. This was done behind a false front of benevolence, good intentions, and concern. They did not believe in celebrating victories too much. They claimed they were afraid that such celebrations were unworthy of a great nation and out of place. The bravery and heroism of the German soldier were to be taken for granted because they were accepted facts which did not justify such jubilation. They said outbursts of joy should not be encouraged because foreign countries may view quiet and dignified rejoicing as more attractive than unrestrained excitement. Finally, we Germans should not forget that the war was not our creation and that we shouldn't be ashamed to admit openly as men that we were ready at any time to do our share in the reconciliation of mankind. It was, therefore, not wise to tarnish the purity of the army's deeds by too much shouting. The rest of the world might not understand such behavior. They said nothing was more admired than the modesty and restraint with which a true hero calmly and silently forgot his deed. That was basically their warning to the people. Instead of bringing these fellows to the forefront and putting them high on a pole with a rope, so that the victorious enthusiasm of the nation should no longer offend the sensibilities of these knights of the pen, people actually began to follow their lead and issue warnings against the unsuitable character of victory celebrations. The politicians never realized that once the enthusiasm was stopped, it could not be revived when it was needed. It is a state of intoxication and must be maintained as such. Without this sort of enthusiasm, how could the nation endure a struggle which would make enormous demands on their spiritual stamina? I knew the nature of the broad masses well enough to realize a showy display of moral superiority was no way to fan the flames needed to keep the iron hot. I thought officials were crazy when they did not act to raise the boiling point, increase the heat of passion, but I surely didn't understand why the government would push policy to restrain the little excitement that existed. The second thing that annoyed me was the attitude that Marxism was acceptable. In my eyes, this just proved that people had no idea how dangerous this disease truly was. They seemed to sincerely believe that by no longer recognizing any political party distinctions during the war, they had brought Marxism to reason and restrained it. Marxism is not a matter of a political party, but of a doctrine which is bound to lead to the utter destruction of humanity. This was not widely understood because that side of Marxist theory was not taught at our Jew-ridden universities. Too many people have been trained to think that if something is not taught in their university, then it is not important enough to pick up a book and learn about it, which is silly, especially among the higher-level government officials and civil servants. This revolutionary trend passed over these intellectual official heads without them paying any attention to it, which is the reason why state institutions usually drag behind private ones. Heaven knows the German proverb is truer of those intellectual officials than of anyone else. What the peasant doesn't know will not bother him. The English idiom is, "What you don't know can't hurt you," a variation of "Ignorance is bliss." If you don't know about a problem, then you cannot make yourself unhappy by worrying about it, is the general term. The few exceptions just prove the rule. It was an unparalleled mistake to identify the German workman with Marxism in August of 1914. When the time came, the German workman chose to free himself from the grasp of the poisonous epidemic, or he could never have taken part in the struggle of the war. But people were stupid enough to think that, now, perhaps Marxism had become nationalistic. This was a stroke of genius, which proves that for many long years none of these official heads of state had ever bothered to study the nature of the Marxist doctrine. If they had done their homework, such a crazy idea would never have survived. Marxism's ultimate goal is and always will be the destruction of all non-Jewish national states. It was horrified to see that in July of 1914, the German working class, which it had previously trapped, was waking up and quickly entering the service of the fatherland. Within a few days, the whole smokescreen of this deceit, of this infamous fraud on the people, was blown away, and suddenly the Jewish leaders were alone and deserted. It wasn't as if there wasn't a trace left of the nonsense and insanity which they had been boring into the masses for 60 years. It was a bad moment for the deceivers of the German working class people, but the instant the leaders recognized the danger that threatened them, they donned their tarn caps and boldly pretended to take part in the national revival. A tarn cap, or tarn cape, means a magical cap that allows the wearer to take any form they wish. Siegfried uses one in Wagner's operas, and the reference is common in Germanic stories. Other stories give it the power of invisibility and strength. However, it is likely Hitler was referring to Wagner's version, meaning the people put on the trappings and took the form of a nationalist as if by magic. This would have been the time to take a stand against the whole fraudulent brotherhood of Jewish pests hiding amongst the people. Now was the time to give them a severe penance without the slightest consideration for any protest or consequence that might have arisen as a result. In August of 1914, the Jewish chant of international solidarity was gone with a single blow to the heads of the German working class. A few weeks later, this nonsense was replaced by American shrapnel, as it poured the blessings of worker solidarity over the helmets of the marching soldiers' columns. Now that the German workman had returned to his own nationality, it should have been the new duty of any responsible national government to unmercifully annihilate the agitators who stood against it. If the best men were falling at the front, the pest's assaulting national spirit could at least have been exterminated at home. But instead, His Majesty the Kaiser himself held out his hand to these old criminals, offering these disloyal assassins of the nation mercy, protection, and an opportunity to collect themselves for their next strike. The old criminals refers to Dr. Eduard Bernstein, a socialist democrat, and Albert Ballin, managing director of the Hamburg America cruise ships and friends with Wilhelm II. The serpent could then go on working more cautiously than before, but this made him more dangerous. While honest people dreamed of peace and security, the lying criminals were organizing a revolution. I was more than dissatisfied with the fact that officials had settled on a set of terrible half-measures to deal with the problem, but I didn't even realize how horrible the result would eventually be. Then what should have been done next? The leaders of the whole movement should have been put under lock and key immediately. They should have been put on trial and the nation freed from them. Every resource of military power should have been used to brutally exterminate this epidemic. The Marxist parties should have been dissolved and the Reichstag brought to reason at the point of a bayonet if necessary. Or better still, it should have been immediately abolished. Just as the Republic Dissolves Party today, they had even more reason to resort to this means then. After all, the existence or destruction of an entire people was at stake. This would certainly have raised another question. Can intellectual ideas be destroyed by the sword at all? Can violence be used to combat a world concept? I asked myself these questions more than once at that time. If we think through similar cases found in history, especially cases of religious matters, we'll arrive at this principle. After a certain point in their development, concepts and ideas as well as movement of a spiritual nature, whether true or not, can never be broken by force. The only exception is when force is used to replace these ideas with a fresh new idea, thought, or world concept that burns even brighter and stronger than the one it replaces. The use of force alone, without the driving power of a strong spiritual or intellectual concept, can never destroy an idea or even slow how fast it spreads, not unless force is used for the complete extermination of every last supporter and the absolute destruction of all related traditions that may linger. This usually means the disappearance of the state from the realm of political power for a long time and sometimes forever. The state can never stand beside other nations, nor will they allow it after such an exercise of power. Experience shows that a blood sacrifice of this sort hits the nation in the best part of the people. Any persecution carried on without an intellectual or spiritual basis appears morally unjustified, and the people will react. This incites the most valuable part of a population to become champions to the ideas by adopting the beliefs of the unjustly persecuted movement. Many people do this simply out of a feeling of opposition toward the state's attempt to kill an idea by brutal violence. The number of movement followers grows at the same rate that the persecution increases. A complete destruction of the new teaching can only be carried out by a tremendous and ever-increasing extermination, until finally the people or state in question loses all the valuable blood it has. All the people of value are gone. Retribution is then at hand. Such an internal purge may indeed take place, but the price is the loss of a nation's strength. This process will always be useless from the beginning of if the doctrines to be fought have gone beyond a certain small circle. As with all growing movements, destruction is only possible when the movement is young. While resistance increases with passing years, the movement will grow and then yield to fresh and younger members who will spout new groups in a different form with slightly different motives. Almost all attempts to uproot a doctrine and its related organizations by violence, with no intellectual or spiritual basis, are failures. Frequently, in fact, such efforts produce the opposite result from the one intended. When sheer force is used to combat the spread of a doctrine, then that force must be used systematically and persistently. Only regular and steady suppression of a doctrine can be possibly successful. The moment there is any hesitation and violence alternates with mercy, the doctrine being overcome will not only recover, but it will gain new value from each following persecution. This happens because when pressure is eased, resentment at what has been suffered brings new followers to the old doctrine, and existing supporters cling to it with greater defiance and deeper hatred than ever. In fact, after the danger is gone, even those who renounce and betray their movement will try to return to their old beliefs. The only way to achieve success is through a constant and regular use of violence. This persistence can only happen with a definite intellectual and spiritual conviction backing it up. All violence not founded on a solid spiritual or intellectual basis is indecisive and uncertain. It lacks the stability that can only live in a fanatically intense world concept. It flows from the energy and brutal determination of an individual. This dependence on the individual also makes it subject to changes of its nature, personality, and strength as it changes hands. There is still another consideration. Any world concept, whether religious or political in nature, though it can be difficult to tell when one ends and the other begins, strives less for the negative destruction of hostile ideas than to positively affirm its own ideas. Its battle must be more offense than defense. This is an advantage because the movement knows its own goal. The aim is victory for its own idea. On the other hand, it is hard to decide when the negative aim of destroying a hostile doctrine can be considered accomplished and certain. If for no other reason, the world's concepts attack should be better planned and also more forceful than its defense. As in everything else, victory is decided in the attack, not with the defense. A struggle by violence against an intellectual power is mere defense unless the battle is also upholding, proclaiming, and spreading a new intellectual teaching. To summarize, remember this. Every attempt to fight a world concept by violence will eventually fail unless the struggle is fighting for a new way of thinking. Only in a struggle between two world concepts can the weapon of brute force be used persistently and ruthlessly to bring victory to the side it supports. So far, the attempts to combat Marxism had always failed for that reason. This is why even Bismarck's anti-socialist legislation fell short and was destined to fail. There was no new platform, no new world concept that the battle could have been fought for. Only the proverbial wisdom of high ministerial officers could have managed to believe that so-called governmental authority, or peace and good order, or the intellectual driving force was a suitable basis behind a life-and-death battle. Because there was no intellectual concept backing up the legislation, Bismarck handed over the development of his anti-socialist plan to the judgment and goodwill of the very institution that was born of the Marxist way of thinking. When the Iron Chancellor left his war on Marxism to the goodwill of social democrats, Marxists, he was asking the goat to watch the garden. This was the inevitable result since there was no new authoritative fundamental world concept that could drive a strong conquering will into champions who would rebuild this new cause where Marxism was and derive it out. The only result of Bismarck's struggle was a severe disappointment. Were conditions at the beginning of the First World War any different? Unfortunately, no, they were not. The more I thought about the necessary change in the attitude of the government toward social democracy as the temporary personification of Marxism, the more I recognized there was no workable substitute for this doctrine. What could they have offered the masses if social democracy had failed? Not one movement existed that could successfully draw the great crowds of workers under its influence once their leaders were gone. It is silly and more than stupid to presume that the international fanatic, having left his working-class political party, will suddenly join a privileged class party or any new class organization at all. As disagreeable as it may be to various organizations, there is no denying the fact that privileged class politicians have separation of classes or believe separation of classes is important as long as it does not result in apolitical disadvantage. Denying this fact proves the audacity and stupidity of these liars. In general, we must avoid thinking that the masses are more stupid than they actually are. In political matters, decisions are based more on feeling than understanding. The belief that this feeling on the part of the masses somehow proves stupidity towards international matters can be immediately disproved by simply pointing out that a pacifist democracy is equally insane because its supporters are almost exclusively from the intellectual privileged class. When millions of citizens continue to reverently worship their Jewish democratic press every morning, it looks bad for the upper class to make fun of the stupidity of the common comrade, who, in the end, is swallowing the same dirt, just presented differently. The manufacturer is one and the same in both cases, the Jew. We must be careful not to deny things whose existence is obviously a fact. It is an undeniable fact that class questions have nothing to do with ideals, though that tripe is commonly served up at election time. The class arrogance of many upper class people and the low regard of the manual laborer is not in the imagination of the lunatic, but a well-known fact. Apart from this, it shows the small thinking power of our so-called intellectual elite when they assume that circumstances that failed to prevent the rise of Marxism can now somehow find a way to recover what has been lost to it. The privileged class parties can never bring the lower class masses into their camp. These are two worlds that are divided in nature and artificially. When they stand together, there will be battle. But no matter what, the younger one, Marxism, will be victorious. A war on Marxist social democracy in 1914 would have been conceivable. It is, however, questionable how long that fight could have been maintained, considering the lack of any practical substitute. I believed this long before the war, and that is why I could never make up my mind to join one of the existing parties. During the First World War, my opinion was strengthened more by the obvious impossibility of declaring a brutal war on social democracy. There was no movement available that was anything more than a parliamentary party. I openly expressed my beliefs to my close army friends quite often. That is when it first occurred to me that I might someday enter politics. This was why I often assured my circle of friends that after the war, I would become a speaker in addition to my profession. I believe I was very sincere about it.